These are men with bold ideas, but highly critical of their own ideas. They try to find whether their ideas are right by trying first to find whether they are not perhaps wrong. They work with bold conjectures and severe attempts at refuting their own conjectures. These are scientists, but they could be anything. Putting the master in context, Popper was rebelling against the growth of science. Popper intellectually came to the world with the dramatic shifts in philosophy as attempts were made to shift it from the verbal and rhetorical to the scientific and rigorous, as we saw with the presentation of the Vienna Circle in Chapter 4. These people were sometimes called the logical positivists, after the movement called positivism, pioneered in France in the 19th century by Auguste Comte, where positivism meant scientification of things, literally everything under the sun. It was the equivalent of bringing the Industrial Revolution into the soft sciences. Without dwelling on positivism, I have to note that Popper was the antidote to positivism. To him, verification is not possible. Verificationism is more dangerous than anything else. Taken to the extreme, Popper's ideas appear naive and primitive, but they work. Note that his detractors call him a naive falsificationist. I am an exceedingly naive falsificationist. Why? Because I can survive being one. My extreme and obsessive Popperism is carried out as follows. I speculate in all of my activities on theories that represent some vision of the world, but with the following stipulation. No rare event should harm me. In fact, I would like all conceivable rare events to help me. My idea of science diverges with that of the people around me, walking around calling themselves scientists. Science is mere speculation, mere formulation of conjecture. Open Society. Popper's falsificationism is intimately connected to the notion of an open society. An open society is one in which no permanent truth is held to exist. This would allow counter-ideas to emerge. Karl Popper shared ideas with his friend, the low-key economist von Hayek, who endorsed capitalism as a state in which prices can disseminate information that bureaucratic socialism would choke. Both notions of falsificationism and open society are, counterintuitively, connected to those of a rigorous method for handling randomness in my day job as a trader. Clearly, an open mind is a necessity when dealing with randomness. Popper believed that any idea of utopia is necessarily closed, owing to the fact that it chokes its own refutations. The simple notion of a good model for society that cannot be left open for falsification is totalitarian. I learned from Popper, in addition to the difference between an open and a closed society, that between an open and a closed mind. Nobody is perfect. I have some sobering information about Popper the man. Witnesses of his private life find him rather un-Popperian. The philosopher and Oxford don Brian McGee, who befriended him for close to three decades, depicts him as unworldly, except in his youth, and narrowly focused on his work. He spent the last 50 years of his long career, Popper lived 92 years, closed to the outside world, insulated from outside distractions and stimulation. Popper also engaged in giving people firm-sounding advice about their career or their private life, though he had little understanding of either. All this, of course, was in direct contravention of his professed and indeed genuine beliefs and practices in philosophy. He was not much better in his youth. Members of the Vienna Circle tried to avoid him, not because of his divergent ideas, but because he was a social problem. He was brilliant, but self-focused, both insecure and arrogant, irascible and self-righteous. He was a terrible listener, and bent on winning arguments at all costs. He had no understanding of group dynamics, and no ability to negotiate them. I will refrain from commonplace discourse about the divorce between those who have ideas and those who carry them in practice, except to bring out the interesting behavioral problem. We like to emit logical and rational ideas, but we do not necessarily enjoy this execution. Strange as it sounds, this point has only been discovered very recently. We will see that we are not genetically fit to be rational and act rationally. We are merely fit for the maximum probability of transmitting our genes in some given, unsophisticated environment. Also, strange as it sounds, George Soros, obsessively self-critical, seems to be more Popperian than Popper in his professional behavior. Induction and memory. Memory in humans is a large machine to make inductive inferences. Think of memories. What is easier to remember? A collection of random facts glued together, or a story, something that offers a series of logical links. Causality is easier to commit to memory. Our brain would have less work to do in order to retain the information. The size is smaller. What is induction exactly? Induction is going from plenty of particulars to the general. It is very handy, as the general takes much less room in one's memory than a collection of particulars. The effect of such compression is the reduction in the degree of detective randomness. Pascal's wager. I conclude with my exposition of my own method of dealing with the problem of induction. The philosopher Pascal proclaimed that the optimal strategy for humans is to believe in the existence of God. For if God exists, then the believer would be rewarded. If he does not exist, the believer would have nothing to lose. Accordingly, we need to accept the asymmetry in knowledge. There are situations in which using statistics and econometrics can be useful, but I do not want my life to depend on it. Like Pascal, I will therefore state the following argument. If the science of statistics can benefit me in anything, I will use it. If it poses a threat, then I will not. I want to take the best of what the past can give me, without its dangers. Accordingly, I will use statistics and inductive methods to make aggressive bets, but I will not use them to manage my risks and exposure. Surprisingly, all the surviving traders I know seem to have done the same. They trade on ideas based on some observation, that includes past history, but like the Popperian scientists, they make sure that the costs of being wrong are limited, and their probability is not derived from past data. Unlike Carlos and John, they know before getting involved in the trading strategy which events would prove their conjecture wrong and allow for it. Recall that Carlos and John used past history both to make their bets and to measure their risk. They would then terminate their trade. This is called a stop loss, a predetermined exit point, a protection from the black swan. I find it rarely practiced. Thank you, Solon. Finally, I have to confess that upon finishing my writing of part one, that writing about the genius of Solon's insight has carried an extreme effect on both my thinking and my private life. The composition of part one made me even more confident in my withdrawal from the media and my distancing myself from other members of the business community, mostly other investors and traders, for whom I am developing more and more contempt. I believe that I cannot have power over myself as I have an ingrained desire to integrate among people and cultures and would end up resembling them. By withdrawing myself entirely, I can have a better control of my fate. I am currently enjoying a thrill of the classics I have not felt since childhood. I am now thinking of the next step, to recreate a low-information, more deterministic, ancient time, say in the 19th century, all the while benefiting from some of the technical gains, such as the Monte Carlo engine, all of the medical breakthroughs, and all the gains of social justice of our age. I would then have the best of everything. This is called evolution. Part 2. Monkeys on typewriters, survivorship, and other biases. If one puts an infinite number of monkeys in front of strongly built typewriters and lets them clap away, there is a certainty that one of them would come out with an exact version of the Iliad. Upon examination, this may be less interesting a concept than it appears at first. Such probability is ridiculously low. But let us carry the reasoning one step beyond. Now that we have found that hero among monkeys, would any reader invest his life savings on a bet that the monkey would write the Odyssey next? In this thought experiment, it is the second step that is interesting. How much can past performance, here the typing of the Iliad, be relevant in forecasting future performance? The same applies to any decision based on past performance, merely relying on the attributes of the past time series. Think about the monkey showing up at your door with his impressive past performance. Hey, he wrote the Iliad. The major problem with inference in general is that those whose profession it is to derive conclusions from data often fall into the trap faster and more confidently than others. The more data we have, the more likely we are to drown in it. For the common wisdom among people with a budding knowledge of probability laws is to base their decision-making on the following principle. It is very unlikely for someone to perform considerably well in a consistent fashion without his doing something right. Track records, therefore, become preeminent. They call on the rule of the likelihood of such a successful run and tell themselves that if someone performed better than the rest in the past, then there is a great chance of his performing better than the crowd in the future, and a very great one at that. But as usual, beware the middle brow. A small knowledge of probability can lead to worse results than no knowledge at all. It depends on the number of monkeys. I do not deny that if someone performed better than the crowd in the past, there is a presumption of his ability to do better in the future. But the presumption might be weak, very weak, to the point of being useless in decision-making. Why? Because it all depends on two factors: the randomness content of his profession and the number of monkeys in operation. The initial sample size matters greatly. If there are 5 monkeys in the game, I would be rather impressed with the Iliad writer, to the point of suspecting him to be a reincarnation of the ancient poet. If there are 1 billion to the power 1 billion monkeys, I would be less impressed. As a matter of fact, I would be surprised if one of them did not get some well-known but unspecified piece of work, just by luck, perhaps Casanova's Memoirs of My Life. 1 monkey would even be expected to provide us with former Vice President Al Gore's Earth in the Balance, perhaps stripped of the platitudes. This problem enters the business world more viciously than other walks of life, owing to the high dependence on randomness. We have already belabored the contrast between randomness-dependent business with dentistry. The greater the number of businessmen, the greater the likelihood of one of them performing in a stellar manner just by luck. I have rarely seen anyone count the monkeys. In the same vein, few count the investors in the market in order to calculate, instead of the probability of success, the conditional probability of success runs given the number of investors in operation over a given market history. Vicious real life. There are other aspects to the monkey's problem. In real life, the other monkeys are not countable, let alone visible. They are hidden away, as one sees only the winners. It is natural for those who failed to vanish completely. Accordingly, one sees the survivors, and only the survivors, which imparts such a mistaken perception of the odds. We do not respond to probability, but to society's assessment of it. As we saw with Nero Tulip, even people with training in probability respond unintelligently to social pressure. This section. Part 1 describes situations where people did not understand the rare event, and do not seem to accept either the possibility of its occurrence or the dire consequences of such occurrence. It also set out my own ideas, those that do not seem to have been explored in the literature. But a book on randomness is not complete without a presentation of what possible biases one might have aside from the deformations caused by the rare event. The business of Part 2 is more pedestrian. I will rapidly provide a synthesis of the biases of randomness, as discussed in the now abundant literature on the subject. These biases can be outlined as follows. A. Survivorship biases, also known as monkeys on a typewriter, arising from the fact that we see only winners and get a distorted view of the odds. Chapters 8 and 9, Too Many Millionaires and Fry an Egg. B. The fact that luck is most frequently the reason for extreme success. Chapter 10, Loser Takes All. And C. The biological handicap of our inability to understand probability. Chapter 11, Randomness and Our Brain. Chapter 8, Too Many Millionaires Next Door. Three illustrations of the survivorship bias. Why very few people should live on Park Avenue. The millionaire next door has very flimsy clothes, an overcrowding of experts. How to Stop the Sting of Failure. Somewhat happy. Mark lives on Park Avenue in New York City with his wife, Janet, and their three children. He makes $500,000 a year, give or take a boom or a recession. He does not believe that the recent spurt in prosperity is here to last, and has not mentally adjusted yet to his recent abrupt rise in income. A rotund man in his late 40s, with spongy features that make him look 10 years older than his age, he leads the seemingly comfortable but heckled life of a New York City lawyer. But he is on the quiet side of Manhattan residence. Mark is clearly not the man one would expect to go bar hopping or attend late-night Tribeca and Soho parties. He and his wife have a country house and a rose garden and tend to be concerned, like many people of their age, mentality and condition, with, in the following order, material comfort, health, and status. Weekdays, he does not come home until at least 9:30 p.m., and at times he can be found in the office at close to midnight. By the end of the week, Mark is so fatigued that he falls asleep during their 3-hour drive to the house, and Mark spends most of Saturday lying in bed, recovering and healing. Mark grew up in a small town in the Midwest, the son of a quiet tax accountant who worked with sharp yellow pencils. His obsession with sharpness was so strong that he carried a sharpener in his pocket at all times. Mark exhibited very early signs of intelligence. He did extremely well in high school. He attended Harvard College, then Yale Law School. Not bad, one would say. Later, his career took him to corporate law, where he started working on large cases for a prestigious New York law firm, with barely enough hours left for him to brush his teeth. This is not too much an exaggeration, for he ate almost all of his dinners in the office, accumulating body fat and brownie points toward his partnership. He later became a partner within the usual 7 years, but not without the usual human costs. His first wife, whom he met in college, left him, as she was tired of an absentee lawyer husband and weary of the deterioration in his conversation. But ironically, she ended up moving in with, and later marrying, another New York lawyer, probably with no less flat conversation, but who made her happier. Too much work. Mark's body became progressively flabbier, and his bespoke suits needed periodic visits to the tailor in spite of his occasional crash diets. After he got over the depression of the abandonment, he started dating Janet, his paralegal, and promptly married her. They had three children in quick succession, bought the Park Avenue apartment and the country house. Janet's immediate acquaintance is composed of other parents of the Manhattan private school attended by their children, and their neighbors at the cooperative apartment building where they live. From a materialistic standpoint, they come at the low end of such a set, perhaps even at the exact bottom. They would be the poorest of these circles, as their co-op is inhabited by extremely successful corporate executives, Wall Street traders, and high-flying entrepreneurs. Their children's private school harbors the second set of children of corporate raiders from their trophy wives, perhaps even the